Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey hustlers, we know that this 2024, the entrepreneurial journey is filled with challenges. An often overlooked aspect is the time-consuming task of processing payroll and managing government requirements. And did you know that the average admin spends a whopping 50 hours per month dealing with just government compliance? That's time you could be spending on growing your business, or let's be honest, taking a well-deserved break. But fear not, we got a game changer for you, introducing Sprout Solutions and their tailored solutions for MSMEs called the Payroll Starter. With Sprout Solutions Payroll Starter, you can finally reclaim your time and get your life back on track. Say goodbye to the stress of remembering tax dates or worrying about missed payroll runs. This bundle is designed to make your life easier and your business more efficient. And here's the best part. The cost starts just at 5,000 pesos per month for businesses with up to 10 employees. Yep, you heard that right. That's just 5,000 pesos per month. So why spend another minute drowning in payroll paperwork when Sprout can revolutionize the way you manage your payroll and government requirements? Take the first step towards a more efficient business today. Visit sprout.ph/payrollstartermonthly5k. If you missed that, don't worry. We have it in the description box of this episode. So click that too. And again, big shout out to Sprout Solutions because your time is too valuable to be spent on paperwork. Reclaim it with their Payroll Starter. Now let's begin this episode.
The Hustle Share podcast is brought to you by Uno Digital Bank, a full-spectrum digital bank licensed and regulated by the Banco Central ng Pilipinas, or BSP. Manage your money and maximize its potential growth with a secure and trusted bank that fits right in your pocket. Open a savings or time deposit account. Pay bills. Shop with the Uno Virtual Debit MasterCard or apply for a loan in the Uno mobile app today. And brought to you by DragonPay. DragonPay is the pioneer in alternative payments in the Philippines. DragonPay is the reigning fintech of the year in last year's Philippine Fintech Festival. Sign up now at www.dragonpay.ph.
If you really want to help a founder, and if you are an investor or if you are a mentor, you need to now have the skills to allow them to open up. Don't expect that they will come and knock your door and say, you know what, this is bothering me. Not everyone has the ability to do it. They're going to try to solve it as much as they can.
Welcome to Hustle Share, the podcast that features the daily grinds of unique hustlers around the world to show not our differences, but that our hustles are very much alike. Now here's your host, Ronster Baityong.
Welcome to the latest episode of the Hustle Share podcast. It's been a while since I last recorded. I've been batch recording for a while, but again, every single time we do this, it just brings me back to why I do what I do. And I love hearing amazing hustles. And today, it's been someone that I've been wanting to get to know because I've been hearing a lot of great things about you from Go Rocky, from Kindred, from Eileen Bermeh, who is my co-founder here in Podcast Network Asia. The proof is in the pudding. You guys have been doing amazing stuff. And again, shout out to Paolo Campos, who balls in the Pulse 63 shirt whenever we play basketball every Wednesday or Thursday. There's too much good stuff for me not to have this guy on the show. But without getting carried away, let's welcome to the show the managing director of Pulse 63 Healthcare Ventures, Mr. Abdul Parabengo. Abdul, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you, Ron. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Again, I've had a lot of your portfolio companies here. I didn't realize that I was, before we jumped on the recording, I had a look and like, I didn't realize you guys had that many portfolio companies already. I've probably had Probably a handful or less than a handful, but these are probably your best ones by far. The ones that are up and coming, watch out. But again, you guys have been doing an amazing, amazing job. Congratulations. But before I get carried away, I need to ask you the $1 million question. Abdul, what's your hustle?
Oh, it's super tough. It's you don't know what hustle comes your way every day. You wake up, you have 20 different problems from 20 different startups. You want to kind of solve for everything every day. But the objective is, right, I guess, is to how do you kind of help founders build companies that they can claim as successes, right?
Right.
And whatever it takes, right? So our logic is very clear, right? You hustle, we hustle with you. And obviously, if we have to hustle, I need to hustle along the journey as well. So, yeah.
Absolutely.
But,
I'll just go with the basics first. Why did you guys build Pulse63 Healthcare Ventures? Because you could have easily gone the route of like, all right, let's hedge our bets, put one in one startup or two startups or three startups. But I've seen you guys really solving a lot of problems at the same time. But why was Pulse63 even created?
Yeah, so Pulse63 was created about, so first, just to give you context, the 63 in Pulse, the 63 is the Philippines dialing code.
Yes.
That's how it is,
it's a
right?
A lot of people, plus 63, which is...
That's true.
I love it.
That's true, right? And it started about 2.5 years back when Paolo, along with his work wife, Constantine of Locad and Kaya...
that's the term? I did not know.
Yeah, that's how they...
goes by the work wife.
That's how Paolo refers to cons. And then along with Paolo and Cons came Abatina of Equilife, who's part of Endeavor, and her husband Stefan, who's been with Antler and AXA, and they wanted to build something together, right? And one common sectoral theme that came about was healthcare, right? Because Abbott has been in the healthcare space. Paolo has family connections to the space. And that's how they kind of decided. And it seemed like a space where there were tons of problems to solve for.
Yep.
And, they started off, and a year later is when I kind of took leadership for Pulse63. But for me, healthcare was a very logical space to be in, because when I started my career about 15 years back with a Dutch logistics company called TNT, I was doing healthcare logistics. I spent about five years doing healthcare logistics. So I'd seen all the different aspects of healthcare. And over a period, I kind of moved around within healthcare in some forms and shapes, right? And second, for me, I've also been an angel investor in, obviously from my own sort of capital, right? But one thing that I've kind of realized is fintech, while there's a big valuation game and consumer tech is a network game, health tech is a game that you can play even if you weren't super good at fundraising.
Right.
And for countries like Philippines, which may not have significant amount of VC capital moving around, health tech seemed to be the right space. So yeah, that's how the whole healthcare thing came about. But again, we also realized that we have a great team. You know, it's a market that has significant amount of problem. Mm-hmm. And if we have to solve for it, it can't be one single startup, right? And then how do we kind of build this repeatable playbook, which other great founders can come along and take a ride on top of it, right? So it's the fact that you're trying to bring great founders together with a baseline, which is a repeatable playbook across in one single sector.
That is amazing. Now, all right, we now have to take a step back, because you mentioned already that you were once in this space already. Again, but before we even talk about how you got into the space, we need to go all the way back and understand the origin story of the young Abdul, because we're going to have to ride the Hustle Share time machine. There you go. We're going back to India. All right. We're all the way back now. I don't want to understand, Abdul. Again, you mentioned that you are from India, but describe to me what was growing up like. And were you part of an entrepreneurial family? Are you part of, do you even have healthcare back when you were young at all? What was that like? And what was your first exposure to hustling?
I only was in India for about 3 months from the time I was born.
Wow.
So we have a large OFW-like base in India.
Yeah.
We don't call it OFW. We call it NRI, which is non-resident Indian.
Oh, that's a term. I did not know that. Okay.
Yeah. And so my dad, my mom, and, you know, they were based in Saudi Arabia, right? And 3 months later, I moved to Jeddah in Saudi, and that's where I grew up. I did my entire schooling in Saudi. So I lived there for about 16 plus years. And, you know, when you live in a country like Saudi, right, you end up doing a lot of hustle, right? You know, because you don't have, I mean, I'm sure you must have heard of the restrictions and the challenges.
I've actually been to Saudi in 2022. I was invited over to this podcast conference in Riyadh. I almost backed out because, like, this looks so shady. I couldn't even research anything. And I was like, what the hell is this? And then I already backed out. And then one of my friends from the startup ecosystem, I mean, podcast ecosystem says, hey, I'm coming. Can you come too? Just to make sure that we hedge our bets and we survive this, whatever this whole thing is. Little did we know that they're going to freaking fly us. Sorry, we're digressing here, but I just wanted to share my Saudi experience real quick. But we flew out. It was literally 3 days after I pulled a big ass screw off of my leg because I broke my leg. I broke my ankle. Literally, if you're not going to be able to see this, those people are listening, but I had this screw in my in my tibia and my fibula because I broke my ankle. And it's literally 3 days after I started walking again, they flew me out along with my wife to Riyadh, business class, directly to Riyadh, and they chauffeured us around. I've never felt like a bother. Riyadh is amazing.
Yeah, it is, right?
Kamsa on Kamsa. That's all I ate.
No, but it wasn't the same Riyadh about
Correct. So that's what I want to know. Because I heard there's, like, recently when we got there, it's only been like a year or two since the women started
driving.
And also they're now allowed to go to cinemas and all that. So these are all new to them because of MBS, right? But what was it like before?
Yeah, it was... Just to give you a few instances, right? One is every mall, every quick service restaurant, like your KFC, McDonald's, would have a singles entry section and a family entry section.
What?
So if you're a male single, you can only enter from the single side. If you're a female single, you enter from the female section.
Okay.
And you don't get to see each other, right? Nope. It's carved out as separate sections, right? You know, if you're roaming around the streets during the prayer time, you would be, if you're a Muslim, you would be kind of asked to go to the mosque and pray. And if you still don't adhere to it, you'll be kind of, you know, going through the procedure of cleaning the mosque for 40 days back to back or something of that sort. That's the punishment, right?
Wow.
Yeah. So it was a bit tough, at least for us, being a Muslim and, you know, having, you know, the fact that we grew up there, we kind of were okay with it. But when you think about it now and how the other parts of the world operate, it kind of feels, oh, you know what? There was a point of time that it operated like that, right? But it's kind of reviving. It's kind of opening up to the world. And I love the fact that they're doing that as well, right? So, yeah, for me, being in Saudi, you didn't have a lot of entertainment options. The only way was to play football or cricket because, you know, you had a lot of South Asian crowd and then you had the Arab crowd who loves football. We did have a lot of Filipinos as well, but Filipinos had their own communities, right?
Dude, when I was there the whole time, people would be like, Kabayan! Like, how the hell do they even know I'm... Of course, I look Filipino as hell. But man, everybody just... started calling me, Kabayan! Like, okay, what up, man? Okay.
Indeed, right? And so we used to do a lot of, you know, publishing, actually, right? So we used to write books, weeklies, magazines, and then kind of rent it out to a bunch of school students and other communities. We used to have our own tournaments where you could kind of enroll your teams or, and then we kind of take a sign up fee. And then at some point in time, we kind of distribute a portion of that to the winners and stuff like that.
Wow.
But it was fun, right? I think Saudi is what gave me the foundation to be building multiple large-scale businesses or operating large-scale businesses because you get exposed to one, different nationalities, different set of people, different set of problems, and all of those, right? So, yeah.
Sounds good. Now, after that, again, walk me through school. Like, where did you study school? Because I'm looking at your LinkedIn again. Just I'm coming in blind. But it says here that you went back to Delhi to study. So what was that like? And what was the path that you took professionally to get to where you are?
So I did my schooling at International Indian School, Jeddah. So that's the school, right? Yeah. So after schooling, what happens is most of the Indians used to come back to India or go to other markets to study because you didn't have a good university system in the Saudi at that point in time.
Makes sense.
I chose to come back to Bangalore, which is considered the Silicon Valley of Bangalore of India and also the BPO hub of India. Mm-hmm. Went there, did my bachelor's in commerce.
Oh.
And yeah, that was about 3 years. It was at Garden City College, which was part of Bangalore University. That went on to become a deemed university. So it's no more a college. It's a Garden City University at this point in time.
Nice.
Spent 3 years there, but I actually didn't study a lot, I would be honest, right? Mm. I was running a restaurant beside the campus. Mm. And because we were running a restaurant, we used to get attendance and pass marks. Nobody really bothered us. And then after that, I was thinking of what to do next. And the logical answer should have been MBA. Mm. And usually what happens is at that point in time, this was 2008, everyone was doing an MBA in finance or HR or operations and some of those stuff. And that's when I kind of heard of supply chain and it sounded fancy. I didn't know what it was. Yeah. It just sounded fancy. And I was like, you know what? This probably looks nice. Let's do this, right?
All right.
And that's when I was looking at universities which had supply chain master's program. And that's when I realized Indian Institute of Technology. So IITs is kind of a good tag to have, right? That's one of the prestigious campuses in India.
Okay.
And got through to IIT in Delhi, moved there, did my master's in supply chain. Mm-hmm. That's been my background in terms of education.
That's amazing. But again, one thing I want to zero in, so obviously you can easily spot this resume, but one thing that you didn't mention is on your LinkedIn is you ran a restaurant, right? And you're running a restaurant, you develop soft skills and hard skills. That obviously carry on to your career. While you're doing this right at the same time, while you're doing the stuff you're doing at school, what were the skills that you developed here? Because this is technically entrepreneurship in its very core, right? Restaurants, buying and selling. This is what entrepreneurship at the very core, at the very start of it is. And what did you learn there to still apply to what you do now?
I think one is you need to do the dirty stuff. You can't step away from it, right? I still remember every day I used to wake up at 4:30 and go to the wet market.
Wow.
To buy the meat for the restaurant. And by the time I come back from the wet market to the restaurant, I'd be on my bike. And that's the time that I would have my college mates or batchmates walking to the campus. And I'm kind of carrying bags of meat and rice and stuff and going to the restaurant. So one, you have to kind of step in where it's required and you have to do the dirty job. And you also need to understand that you have to be shameless, right?
Right.
And today, honestly, if there's any requirement and if somebody says, you know what, I can't be there, I'll take the car and go, or I'll take a Grab bike and go or whatever, right? Move it and go, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think you have to be shameless, relentless, and you have to be willing to do the dirty job. You can't delegate it always.
Definitely.
If you expect someone else to do, you should also know to do it and show that you're committed to it.
Especially if you're a 0-1 founder.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Even I think at some point in time, right? I think when you do become a large company, right? What happens is some of your leadership might kind of move away from the ground reality. And
Correct. The
only way to bring them back to reality is you say, you know what? Once a month, everyone's going to do deliveries, right? To understand what happens on ground, right? Or we might man the store. Right? And things of that sort, right? I think,
That's especially true considering, if you're a 0-1 founder and especially you're doing all of these startups at the same time.
Yeah.
As a founder, you need to be ready to roll up your sleeves. And the best way for you to do that is start early, roll up your sleeves, leave your ego at the door. People will see you for sure. And if you have that ego blocking and your judgment, you're already probably halfway toward your failure point in startups because it's dirty work at all the time. And regardless of how far along are you in your journey, if you're not willing to go back to basics because you're the last line of defense, it's going to be very difficult, right? You need to be able to do the dirty work. I love that stuff. So after this, you've now obviously been in supply chain, and you mentioned earlier that you went to TNT. I thought, stupid me, I thought the same TNT, the Turner Networking Company, is the same TNT. Like, ooh, is it the same company? Apparently, it's almost the same logo. But
I remember when I used to, when I had started with TNT, at least in the Middle East, TNT, the Cartoon Network was part of TNT. And they were like, oh, yeah, they were like, are you working with the Cartoon Network, TNT, whatever, right? Yeah, but no. So this is a Dutch-based logistics company. We had about 50 plus aircrafts. It's an orange logo. You know, a few years back, it got acquired by FedEx for about $5+ billion.
What?
Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. And this is your entry point towards contract managing the healthcare ecosystem and whatnot. But while you were here, is this one of your first few jobs? What was the problem that's persistent that you've seen in this ecosystem, especially in India? Because I always say this, India and the Philippines have so many parallels. It's almost 1A, 1B. The only difference is it's obviously India is 12x the Philippines, right? More or less. But the problems that exist in India, if it exists there, it's almost sure that it also exists here in the Philippines. But what were these problems that you see in the healthcare sector in India back then?
So I think back in India, like unlike Philippines, right? I think if you had to kind of see what's the metro city here, the largest is Manila, right? Everything ends up in Manila in some form or shape, right? But in India, it does not end up in one city, right? Most likely, right? Because we have a problem of Mumbai. We have a problem of Delhi, Chennai, Bangalore, multiple cities, right? And that brings about a logistical nightmare for anyone selling any form of physical product. And then at that point in time, the tax structure was provincial. It wasn't a central tax structure. So which means each time you will cross state border from one state to the other, you had to do a lot of paperwork, right? Yeah. So you know, most of these large pharma companies and healthcare companies ended up having 20 plus warehouses in a country, one warehouse per state, right? You know, all of those, right?
That's challenges. A mess.
Yeah.
Okay. So when this is the thing, and then again, in line with healthcare, being the contract manager there, what were the problems that you guys were solving, or what were the problems that you had to deal with being there?
So I started off in customer service. And so I spent about a year in customer service where primarily was dealing with any failure. So every shipment did have a calculated transit time. And if we anticipated that, the shipment would not make it in within that defined transit time, the team would intervene and figure out what's the next best alternative and fix for it, right? So we were solving problems and we were solving multiple problems on a daily basis, right? So after spending a year there, moved on to the healthcare team. And that was as a key account, major accounts manager, where we were dealing with large pharma companies like Sanofi, Roche, Abbott, and all of those, and trying to help them optimize their cost per package. Now, that meant creating custom solutions, right? Because in healthcare, you have temperature sensitive and time sensitive cargo. You know, you have to reverse engineer, right? Rather than saying, oh, this is my transit time. And then moved into the contract management role where I was responsible for a few large global accounts like the Siemens, WHO, and stuff. Mm-hmm. And the problems there were completely unique because Siemens and WHO had high value items or they were focused on rural healthcare. They were spread across multiple pockets of the country. And then you had to kind of deal with that. Mm-hmm. So I'd say, you know, moved on from problem solving on a day-to-day basis to solving problems at a company level on the supply chain side, and then taking that to a more niche crowd. So that's the kind of transition there.
Okay, sounds good. And after that, obviously, you went to Crystal Group to be the head of strategy and business support for 11 months. But one thing that's really sticking out here is that after that, you now went back to the Gulf, back to the other side, to be in Qatar, to be a country operations manager and group operations manager of Continental Group Holding. Being in India, and again, getting perspective, and you've always had a wide perspective because you've been to Middle East and India. You have both perspectives going on with you. But going back, but now as a country operations manager, what was that like and what were you doing in Continental Group Holding?
So in the Middle East, as you probably would have realized, what happens is big brands don't get to operate themselves. They need to have a local partner. And Continental was the local partner for brands like Mitsubishi, Toshiba, Polaroid, Samsung, and all of those big brands, right? So we were technically those brands in those markets. And you know, when you operate in that category that a Toshiba or a Samsung operates, what happens is you also have after-sales service, right? So it's basically handling everything in the company except for sales function and the IT function.
Right.
And and for all the brands, right? That's where I started off in Qatar. And honestly, I think 70% of the team was Filipinos, actually.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
That's where I got introduced to Jollibee.
Oh, all right. Yeah, that's good.
That's the first encounter with Jollibee.
I hope the Jollibee, I think I'm for sure the Jollibee in Qatar is halal. Okay. I'm not sure if it's halal here.
It is, yeah.
You're gonna get a halal in Qatar.
Yeah.
If it's haram, good luck. Right?
Yeah.
They're not gonna make it out. But I want to understand now. Okay, we're here. You mentioned in your first stint in TNT, obviously, customer service, supply chain, that's the stuff that you're dealing with. But at this level, when you're you're technically the country lead now and operating so many brands, what did you develop as a leader now? What's the skill stack like that you're developing here? Especially now, again, you're working with noisy Filipinos who like to do chismis sometimes. Just kidding. But yeah, you had to diversify and upskill yourself as well, for sure. What was that like?
I think the bigger challenge was also the fact that Continental was a family-run business, right? They had grown to whatever scale they were. It was a family-run business with people who had spent about 15 to 20 years in the same company, right? Even employees have been there for ages, right?
Wow.
So there was really no progression in terms of technology adoption. So the biggest thing was, while I come in here, I don't have visibility on what's happening, right?
Okay.
The first thing that we went through was enabling technology, and examples included at some point in time, what happened was if somebody had a photocopy machine or a scanning machine or a printer from Toshiba and something goes wrong, they used to call a helpline number, used to call a landline number, and somebody answers and says, okay, our engineer will come in the next 2 days. And then the engineer is sent there. Once the engineer goes there, he checks the equipment and then he realizes I need 5 parts to be replaced.
So
the next day what happens is he comes to the office, tells the person who answered the call that these are the 5 parts that I need, and the person who answered the call sends a proposal to the customer saying that these are the 5 parts, this is the price, do you agree? When they reply, the next day the engineer goes to replace it, right? So it took about 7 days, right?
Oh my god.
Yeah. What we did was we got the engineers to go out with tablets. So when they go there, what happened is they could see what spare part they needed. They could get the part ID number, enter it in the system immediately, which means it triggered to the telesales team that existed there. And the proposal was automatically generated on the same day, right?
Right. And you got to go ahead.
Exactly, right? And if you get a go ahead, the warehouse team already keeps it ready. And the next day, it's already scheduled. So what we did was we turned around from a more than 7 day kind of period to less than 72 hours, which technically meant we could charge more, right?
Nice.
To our clients, right? So I think those kind of skills, right? How do you kind of optimize for processes? How do you improve processes that lead to revenue or margin improvement?
Right. But you mentioned that a lot of the people here have been here in ages. I'm pretty sure there's a lot of pushback that you had to go through because, like, who is this guy trying to, you know, not break the things that still work? You know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it type of thing. How did you get the buy-in and slowly implement this? Because, of course, people who are used to doing a lot of things for a long time will not agree and won't be popular in that regard.
No, I think my logic there is I'm not at Facebook for people to like me, right? I'll ruffle feathers. I really don't care, unfortunately, right? Mm-hmm. But in any company, what happens is you'll have a few people who do want some change, and they do understand that any positive change will, you know, improve in their own living, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is, but you know, there's outcomes there, right? There's gain there, right? But more importantly, the other thing, especially in this context of Continental, what I did was we used to operate 6 days a week.
Okay.
We kind of moved that to 5 days a week, and Filipinos loved it, right? Because they wanted to go for their bowling and they wanted to go for their basketball and everything, right?
Right.
Yeah. So we kind of, what we did is we reduced the number of days, but increased the working hours. So it's a win-win for both the company and the employee. And nice. They kind of realize that this is a positive change, first step, and we do more, we get more changes, right, towards their own kind of work-life balance, right?
That is amazing. Now, let's take a first break, and when we come back, we will now discuss what Abdul was able to do with his career, and again, how that led him to create Pulse 63, and how that works now with all the startups that they've been doing in the healthcare sector here in the Philippines. But let's talk about that more after the break.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey guys, I have a very, very exciting opportunity I want to share with you guys. If you're a B2B startup founder, listen up. Your ticket to growth is here. Introducing Impact 24, the Philippines' largest B2B SaaS challenge. Calling all startups in their pre-launch, pre-seed, or seed stages, this is your chance to accelerate your growth, submit your pitch to Impact 24, and get ready for a 10-week intensive program to elevate your solution. What's in it for you? How about up to 500,000 pesos in MVP project support, exclusive credits from industry partners, personalized mentoring, and a shot to pitch at SaaSCon PH, the country's biggest SaaS conference this April. But yo, you gotta hurry up because submissions close on January 26, 2024 already. Don't miss out on this opportunity to take your startup to new heights. Apply now at saaschallenge.ph, that's saaschallenge.ph. And good luck, and I'll see you guys in Impact 24. And we're back with Rick. We are still with Abdul Paravengal that told us why he went back to the other side. Is it the Gulf of India? I forgot what body of water is it.
The Arabian Sea.
The Arabian Sea. Okay, thank you. Right? Yeah. Somewhere in between India and another big peninsula called Saudi Arabia. That thing. Okay, I'm bad with my geography is really bad today. All right. So again, you came back. Obviously, you ran Continental Group. Then you went back to India again to run Healthcare International Lead for Critical Log for a couple months. And then you also did Tribo Hotels. When you went back, what did you then now bring with you? And what's a different perspective running these two companies for periods of months?
Yeah, I think the first stint with TNT was in a large corporate, pretty structured, of those. And then the next two stints, which was the Crystal and the Continental, was family-run businesses where I was technically disconnecting ownership from management, right? And when you kind of do that, you have the ability to kind of build something from scratch or go in an unstructured environment. And that's when one of my ex-bosses from TNT was starting up his logistics business called Critical Log. And he said, why don't you come and join us? I joined him, helped him for a while. And, you know, obviously that was my first startup experience. Capital was an issue and I hadn't experienced anything on fundraising. So I said, you know what, let me move on. And that's how I went to Tribo Hotels.
Okay.
And Tribo is like your Red Doors in India, right?
Got it.
And I was leading Mumbai, and Mumbai happens to be the most expensive real estate in India. right?
Wow.
So hotel prices are usually 3x expensive compared to the next most expensive city. I was leading Mumbai, did really well, and then got an opportunity to kind of lead Goa as well along. Did that for a while, but what happens is when you do have a competition that's backed by SoftBank, things can never be good. So that's when I moved into Oyo, which was the SoftBank-backed competition.
Got it. So in that said, when you're Oyo, and this is the time where all these, I forgot the category of this. So Oyo, Red Doors, Freebo, right? These are the ones.
Budget that, hotels, budget hotel. Franchise model. Yeah.
Correct. What was that like now? And again, this brought you back to Saudi, back where it all started. But at that point, Saudi, again, isn't the Saudi that we know now. It's starting to get to that level, but it's not the Saudi that's progressive and whatnot. How, obviously, being in Saudi before gave you that unfair advantage because you've been there before. But what's that like, considering that this is now the SoftBank backed company that you're working with?
Yeah. So the reason I moved into Saudi was because I had a non-compete clause.
With you can't Freebo, do it in India.
Right. Oh. Yeah. So the choice was, Oyo said, pick a market where you want to go. They said Malaysia, China, wherever you want. And I said, I obviously want to go back to Saudi because that's where my family is. And yeah, they said, we don't operate there, but if you want to go, go and establish it, go and launch it for us. So went there. It took a while to go there because we didn't have the legal entity to do visa and anything of that sort.
Right.
But the fact was, we were blessed because the largest investor in SoftBank Visions Fund was PIF, which is the sovereign wealth fund of Saudi.
Of course.
Right?
Right.
Yeah. So we got the visa process through the office of MBS, went there. It was an easy market because you didn't have to do anything. You literally had to say that you're backed by the PIF and hotel owners would partner with you. So,
right.
Yeah. Yeah. That was the easiest market to operate in. And the fact is that, you know, I knew Arabic to a great extent. I knew how relationships were built there. It was a fairly easy
market.
You
spoke Arabic for sure fluently?
I would say I could read and I could write and I could speak 70% there. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
All right. So the fact that you can do that already sets you at an unfair advantage. And again, and you can just name drop BIF. We're good.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's amazing. Right. Now, I want to understand. So you did that for a few months. And then, again, just basing it off of your LinkedIn, you went to become the director of growth in Miro. And then a couple more stints like delivery in India. So you just really kept going back and forth.
Yeah.
Up until the one that I really, really want to talk about is Shipper. This is now where we're going back from Middle East to India, Middle East to India, up until you went all the way to the biggest Muslim country in the world, which is Indonesia. What brought you there? And what was that experience like? How did that opportunity even present itself?
Yes. So Oyo was a unicorn, which is obviously $1 billion-plus valuation company, right? And from there, I went to Miro, which was another unicorn. And then I went to Delivery, which is another unicorn. I kind of moved from corporates to family-run businesses to three unicorns. And I was like, you know what? I want to go early stage now, right?
Mm.
And that's also the time that I was kind of going on with my fiance, who was an Indonesian. And we had seen both sides of the world, right? India and Indonesia.
There you go.
Yeah. So the quality of life in Indonesia was a lot better. And we kind of said, let's try Indonesia, right?
Got it.
And I was reaching out to a few people over LinkedIn and saying that they do want to move and they prefer early stage opportunities, and had two possibilities at that point in time. And it happened super quick.
Okay.
Reached out on LinkedIn over the next 5 days, two possibilities came up. They said, why don't you fly down? They booked my flight. I came down, met them. The subsequent day got two offers, but I chose Shipper because it was logistics. They only raised about $5 million at that point in time. They were $20 million valuation. About 70 employees, out of which only probably 5 people could speak English.
You had to learn Bahasa, my man. And that's where your fiance will come in handy.
I know, right? But I haven't learned Bahasa apart from the Satu Dua basics, right?
Did you?
That's it, actually, right? So,
how did you build a team if there was that basic? And again, English isn't that predominant, similar compared to here in the Philippines.
So, moving there, the logic was they weren't sure what I could do in a new market. I wasn't sure what I could do. right? So we agreed on, let's put a title that doesn't impact anyone. Let's call it the chief of staff, right?
Got it.
Came in as a chief of staff, sat through a bunch of meetings, understood what the business is. And then I kind of realized, you know what, this somehow needs to evolve over a period, right? And then I kind of carved out two people from out of the five who could speak English, and started experimenting these projects, right? Once these projects kind of materialized, we then started building out teams to scale on those. And that was a team that could speak better English, had a different kind of background.
Right.
And we built on top of it from there on. So, you know, and obviously the chief of staff role only continued for a few months. Investors wanted to have a full-time CFO. And I ended up taking the CFO role while donning the hat of chief of staff. And then at some point in time, kind of donned the hat of CFO and chief business officer. But the transition was, we didn't know what to do. We were figuring it out. We put a small team on the side.
Right.
We figured, we scaled it.
That is intense, because being chief of staff is already a big role on its own, considering also the language barrier. And then you take on chief financial officer. And you mentioned you only had like $20 million valuation at that point. And you had to do hyper growth. Those are two very polarized roles that you're going to have to do. I want to understand, being CFO of a startup, that's, again, obviously it sits here in your LinkedIn, you've raised $100 million across equity and debt from Sequoia, DST, and Prosys on a Series B. How do you even prep? Because that's it's not even hyperscale, but that's such a fast-paced environment that you really need to make sure you hit milestones to unlock that capital, or else you run out of money. What was that like, being the CFO and even chief business officer of a company that's at running at that pace?
I can't even think of it now. But yeah, we went from two warehouses to 300 warehouses.
What?
In 18 months.
That is crazy.
I even remember the first, the third month after joining, the HR had asked me, what's our goal for next year, right? I had kind of said 1,000 employees, you know, but we kind of achieved that number halfway through the year.
Oh my God.
But I think we're very clear. We wanted to find something that works. And we found that in the first few months.
Yeah.
And then we were very clear, we're not going to get distracted by any of this. Just keep executing it. And we need to dominate the market, obviously, because if you do dominate the market, you do have a lot of cost efficiencies, a lot of central advantages in terms of, you know, shared resources and stuff.
Right.
But because this being a physical, operational intensive business, which means you need to pay upfront deposits for landlords, you need to, you know, do CapEx to renovate your properties, all of those, you know, it was tough. We didn't know how to kind of look at it tomorrow, but we also were confident on what we were executing, right? And I think that's where the CEO and the co-founder was instrumental, right? He was very clear, continue to execute. And when we do have to raise capital, we will figure out. He, along with the team, we were very clear that the story is right. We're building on fundamentals. And, you know, if not us, who else?
Got it. That's a very strong narrative. But on the number side, again, whatever you can share, don't if you're still on NDA, please don't get the NDA. But I want to understand, when you're telling that narrative, the numbers should back it up.
Yeah.
And you're in charge of the numbers, right?
Yeah.
What were those numbers that you were basically making sure that you optimized for, so that when the story is told, it matches? It's not like, what the hell is this? If somebody looks at your cap table, it doesn't match your narrative. So what were those optimizations, and what were those numbers you guys had to drive hard on?
I mean, it was consistent revenue growth, right? I think 15-20% month-on-month revenue growth was super important, right? Like, there's no getting away from it, right? And it was not 15-20% at a consolidated level. On any business line that we operated, you had to deliver that. So you can't kind of make up from the other business while the other one was doing bad, right?
Right.
So first was revenue growth. The second was the kind of productivity, right? So what's the kind of contract value per salesperson in the team? What's the contract value per account manager? What's the number of packages that each warehouse staff is kind of picking and packing on a daily basis? What's the revenue per square meter, right? So productivity metrics, right, across teams. That was the second thing. And the third thing was, is there path to profitability, right? Mm. You know, today you may not, but do you have visibility either given by scale or by whatever, right? I think the last piece was, do we have visibility to moving from a negative working capital to a positive working capital cycle? Mm. Today, you might have to pay rent upfront to the landlord, but after you've been in that facility for a year, will the landlord kind of allow you to pay on a monthly basis, probably on a credit period and things like that, right? Mm. So these are the five things that we based our decisions and any efforts around, actually.
And with that experience, I assume this is also the same lens you use now when you look at all the startups that you work with, that they do understand these metrics. Because again, if they're in it and they're trying to be cute, they want to create a startup, but whatnot. But if they don't understand the metrics and also the pace of how startups should be executing at, and they cannot keep up with that growth, then it's going to be difficult. Is that a fair assumption here, considering that you've been an operator, you've been the one running these metrics, you've optimized it and you made sure they hit it? Because if you don't hit it, good luck trying to, I don't care whatever narrative you say, but if your numbers don't back it up, it's going to be very hard.
Yep. I think that's one, like a lot of the times we've had great founders who we believed could have, not I wouldn't say founders, but great talent in the market who we believed could have delivered extremely well and have performed well in their past career kind of sort of stints, have not probably been part of Pulse because they could not understand what metrics they would look at for a specific business model. So if we spoke about e-commerce business in the pet space, right, for dog food, cat food, or whatever, and they couldn't understand what are the three metrics that they wake up to, we wouldn't want to go through that because you can't teach metrics to someone, right? Because the metrics that matters today may not be the metrics that matter tomorrow, right? Exactly. You need to figure out what metrics needs to be optimized. So I would say, yes, I think it's super, super critical.
Yeah, because again, if you cannot drive those metrics, your resume does not matter. Because of course, the resume basically says a past performance, pedigree, and whatnot. But if you don't understand that at the core of it all, good luck trying to be a founder also, because it's a totally different ballgame. And again, we're now down to our last few stops. Because here, a couple of things. After Shipper, you also put up your own. This is now where you put the CEO hat at Have. What's Have? Because I also ran Jacket right along with this, but what's Have, and you're still running this to this day?
So Have is basically an app that's free for consumers. You download the app, and if need be, you integrate your wearable. It could be any wearable that you have. It could be Apple Watch, Fitbit, whatever. If you don't want, it's fine. We track your health activities, your steps, your sleep, and so on. And if you're doing good, we'll reward you with points, and you could use those points to buy discounted products and services, right?
Nice.
So that's the app. You know, underneath that, in some markets, we also had our own health and wellness debit card. So if you have earned enough points, you could use those points to redeem for a health and wellness debit card. And that card could be used for further discounts at offline purchases as well, right? That's the story. And we started building that. We took about 3 months to build the product.
Okay.
We launched that. So we had raised about $500,000 in pre-seed.
What?
Pre-product revenue. Yeah. Mm.
That's pedigree right there. That's a bankable pedigree, because the guy's been running so many great startups as well. So that's it. Okay. Yeah. No, but... I'll digress a little bit. How do you even raise? I've only seen probably a handful of people who's been able to do this. And the people that can raise this amount of money at pre-seed, pre-revenue, pre-whatever, usually comes with a lot of pedigree. And sometimes, or actually majority of the time, they're a repeat founder. They've been proven great operators in a big scale, unicorns, what have you, right? Or third, it's because they have pedigree that they've built along with the resume that comes along with it. But how do you even raise for something pre-product, pre-seed, whatever, with that $500,000 right away off the bat?
It's not an alien concept as much as it sounds in the Philippines, right? I think markets like India and the US are kind of used to that. You know, what happens there is if you're a great founder, they look at it, right? Like if you were working somewhere, you probably were getting paid about 20, 25K USD per month. Mm-hmm. And if I wanted you to kind of start off, you know, I need to give you capital so that your time spent on this is worth it, right? It's not in terms of salary, but if you don't have enough capital, you can't execute to the full vision exactly. that you have at the speed that you did want, right? Mm. It's tough, but you need to have a great plan. You need to have great track record. You need to raise it ideally from the relationships that you've built over the last few years.
Correct.
So it's like, you know, if this guy is getting into something, he knows what he's getting into, right?
The only guy I've been seeing that do that here recently is Fred Levy. Mm-hmm. Of Toki. Mm. That's the guy.
Yeah.
Like, because he told me, like, before he even launched Toki, like, yeah, we raised $1 million pre product, pre. I was like, what the hell? That's crazy. Just because, again, and I'll give flowers to Fred. He's the former CEO of Cash Cash Pinoy. He sold the company forgot the name of the ad agency he had. Plus, he became chief commercial officer of GCash. So when you have that type of pedigree, it's easy to make a bet.
True. And the team that he's put together at Toki is impressive, right? It's the four founders, if I'm not wrong. Lovely team, Jules, right? Like all of similar pedigree, right?
Right. Zoe and all that. So again, amazing, amazing founder. So that's what I want to know. So as you're doing Hav, right? And you're still running this. Again, you double down. Now becoming CEO. What's the experience like? And how different is it being, again, guy number two or guy number three? Now the buck stops with you.
Yeah.
You are the guy. What was that like?
It's tough, right? Because when you're number two and you're number three, you have a shoulder to cry on. You know, if you have a problem, you could go back and kind of rely on them to kind of figure it out along with you, right?
Correct.
When you're number one, you know that you're going through shit, which is what businesses are, right? I mean, it's very unlikely that you have multiple days of good days, right? When you do have a bad day, you do want to kind of open up to someone. But if you are the first in command, you know, if you're the CEO, you may not necessarily have the privilege to do that, right? No. Because you also want to keep up the motivation of the team. You don't want to give them a feeler that things are going wrong.
You
right?
cannot, right?
Yeah.
So there's warriors. You have to be a warrior as a child. So there's a song called Warrior as a Child that you have to put on a face of strength that everything's going to be okay. But deep inside, you're scared of shit, right?
Yeah.
And that's why your peers are so important, because the only ones you can fully understand. And that's why I take so much gratitude towards people that guest on the show, because we're level here. Like, you know exactly the pain I'm going through. And this is like therapy for both of us.
Exactly.
Because the amount of pain that you can only come clean with people, there's layers to that. But only another founder who's probably at number one or number two will fully understand.
Agree. It's that's when you understand. Like, till then, probably you can operate with less emotion. When you reach there, is you kind of get the emotional side of you truly exposed, right? And kind of be protective of it as well. So,
And that's a beautiful thing about this, because now, again, you've been CEO. You've obviously been through the ranks, but you've been CEO. But you know exactly what you need to be when you're nurturing 39 active portfolio companies in Pulse 63. Because in one look, you can already tell what that person is going through. And that's what we're going to be talking about when we come back, because now it's time to talk about Pulse 63, how he was able to get that done, and what are the companies under them. And again, a lot of hot takes, questions from Eileen Borromeo. She wanted me to ask Abdul right here. But let's talk about that more after the break. Hey, Hustlers, it's time to talk business once again, and we're excited to share a bit more info about our sponsor, Sprout Solutions. And again, just like what I said at the start of the episode, you should check out Sprout's Payroll Starter as you grow your own startup, because this bundle that they have is literally what you need to take your startup to the next level as you grow your employees. And this bundle is your key to freedom, including payroll outsourcing to experts, a subscription to timekeeping and attendance software, and government compliance services. Sprout's Payroll Starter
Insider has you covered for payroll, BIR, SSS, and taxes. All the stuff that no founder loves to do. So let Sprout handle the busy work and say goodbye to lines and tax payment stress. All this for as low as 5,000 pesos. Again, that's just 5,000 pesos all in for your payroll and HR needs. So visit sprout.eh payroll-starter-monthly-5k or again, just click the link in the description box of this episode to elevate your business management game. And again, big thank you to Sprout Solutions, liberating your time for what truly matters. Hey hustlers, wish there was an easy way to open a bank account and grow your money without the hassle of lengthy application process and income documents? Well, I got good news because today's sponsor, Uno Digital Bank, is here to help you achieve your financial goals. You can easily open an account with the Uno app in just 5 minutes and one valid ID. And as one of the 6 digital banks licensed by the Banco Central ng Pilipinas, the company is committed to providing customers with simpler, better, and more accessible banking. Last year, Uno Bank was recognized by the Asia Banking and Finance Awards and bagged the title Open Banking Initiative of the Year due to the success of its partnership with GCash, one of the Philippines' leading mobile wallet platforms. And with the Uno mobile app, you can access an hashtag Uno Ready Savings account and enjoy daily interest crediting. With their hashtag Uno Earn or hashtag Uno Boost Time Deposit accounts, you can enjoy a high interest rate of up to 6.5% per annum. Enjoy monthly payouts with hashtag Uno Earn and flexible tenors with hashtag Uno Boost. Other app features include pay bills, the Uno Virtual Debit MasterCard, life insurance, scan and pay with QRPH, and phones. And the one thing that I really love about Uno Digital Bank is they're open to collaborate with a lot of Filipino startups. I've had a chance to see the partnerships that they've had lined up with the startups that they have, and it's truly exciting to see how a digital bank like Uno can enable startups to unlock the power of fintech through digital banking. So if you're ready to elevate your banking experience, download the Uno mobile app today from the Google Play Store or App Store. Or if you want to collaborate with them, I'll be happy to give you an intro. Just shoot us an email at hello@huffleshare.com. Hey hustlers, I hope you're having a great 2024 so far. As you know, a lot of startups had a very challenging 2023, and hopefully things are going to do better this year for a lot of us. Not just because it's the year of the dragon, but also because our sponsor, DragonPay, is here to help your startups process payments in the most efficient way. Established in 2010, DragonPay empowers businesses of all sizes to accept and disperse payments through secure and convenient channels, giving your customers the flexibility to choose the payment method that suits them best. With over 85 partner channels, 35,000 partner branches nationwide, including QRPH, e-wallets, crypto, Buy Now Pay Later, and many more. They also process an astonishing 15 million transactions processed globally each month. DragonPay is your trusted choice for online payments. And here's something to show you how legit DragonPay is. DragonPay was named Fintech of the Year at last year's Philippine Fintech Festival in 2023. So let's make 2024 extra prosperous for you and your startup in this year of the dragon. For more details, head on over to dragonpay.ph. That's dragonpay.ph. Trust the pioneer. Trust DragonPay. And we're back in the break. We are still with Abdul Parvengal that told us the amazing, amazing journeys. Multiple stops that then he took in being CEO. And he still is the CEO of HAB. And man, this guy signed up for really such a tough gig because he's running his own startup. And he's also helping out a lot of other healthcare startups as well. So Abdul, again, walk us through the process of how you went from working on your own health tech startup to becoming the managing director of Pulse 63 to help out other health tech startups, especially here in this market in the Philippines.
Yeah. So what happened was a year and a half into building HAB, we kind of realized that the funding winter had arrived.
Shit.
I've already been investing in startups from my personal capital as an angel. Right. And I kind of realized that consumer tech as a space, while we classified as health tech, in some form or shape, we were a consumer tech company. And we kind of realized that fundraising might become difficult. And that's the point we kind of looked at strategic possibilities. And for Have, we kind of realized that high growth markets like South Asia and Southeast Asia were not the right markets, and Middle East was the right market. So we got a strategic buyer in the Middle East.
Got it.
And that meant it was more of a closed knit operation where I didn't really have to do anything, that they would take over the tech, they would take over everything, they would,
nice.
They would give us a buyout, right? Mm-hmm. And that meant I had to find something that keeps me busy 16 mm-hmm. hours a day or whatever, right? And then when I was looking for opportunities is when I realized that Pulse was looking for something. And I had already known Pulse 63 for a year before that, because when they started off, they had reached out for me to be an investor in Pulse. Oh. I chose not to at that point in time because I didn't understand the venture studio model.
Got it.
But I also had known Constantine because he was running Locad, and Locad was you know, in the same space as Shipper. So we obviously were in touch. And, you know, spoke to the team at Pulse. I spoke to Paolo, and I kind of realized that Paolo is a Kunal Shah, if you've heard of Kunal Shah back in India. So Kunal Shah is a guy who runs this company called Cred, which is $6 billion plus. He's had multiple exits before. He's one name that you would see in most of, almost all the startup cap tables, right? Mm-hmm. And I kind of realized Paolo is like the Kunal Shah and wanting to do really good for the Philippine economy and the startup community here. And if I had the ability to partner up with him, why not, right? And this was one place where I could be an operator, entrepreneur, and an investor at the same time with a team like Paolo, Cons, Abbott, and Stefan. So I was like, no way I'm thinking of anything else. I need to get this done. And I kind of already had thought through about it. The fact that when I moved from India to Indonesia, I felt it a lot more easier. And I knew that Philippines was a few years behind in terms of startup ecosystem maturity. Yeah. And if I entered earlier, it would have been a lot more easier. So,
right. But it's still very early. There's still a lot of blue oceans out here, and there's a lot of work to be done because it's not easy. Now, again, you're right through this. And I want to understand at the core of it all, right? There's several venture builder models that we've seen. There's 917. There's a lot more that we've seen, but what's Pulse 60? What's makes a Pulse 63 different as a venture builder? Obviously, the theme is very, very defined, right? It's healthcare, right? But we've also seen, again, similar models. But what's the difference here? Do you only work with people who you nurture founders, or do you also have founders that already had an idea that would want to be incubated or accelerated by you?
So we have three broad approaches. So we have the build, the co-build, and the rebuild model, right? So the build model is where we look at a problem or an opportunity statement, quantify that, do extensive research, do a list of hypotheses, and validate in terms of demand generation and unit economics. If all adds up, we build a pitch deck, financial model, investment memo, run that business for a while with our capital put in. And then at some point in time, we bring in a founder to run the show, right?
This is the Go-Rocky model.
This is a Go-Rocky model, right? Except that, except that in Go-Rocky, he was the one who validated it from the Pulse side because he was working with Pulse. And when it was ready, we chose him to be the founder, right?
Perfect.
So that's the build model where we did everything from scratch, our capital. Yeah. And then the co-build model is where an existing startup, in this case, like Eileen, who had already started with Life by Petto, think it's a great team, great space. But if they partnered with us, we could do things better, faster, right? So what we do is we kind of go as an institutional co-founder to join the journey. And we say our rewards are aligned because when you make money for equity is when we make money as well, because we don't charge you any service fee or anything of that sort. We're all playing the equity game. And then the logic there is very clear. You have a problem. We know how to solve it. If we don't know how to solve it, we know someone who knows to solve it. And if we don't know that as well, we'll hustle it like you as a founder, right?
Got it.
So that's the co-build model. Mm-hmm. And then the third model is the rebuild model, where we look at companies that have raised capital in the past from VCs, but have burned through that capital for whatever reason and are not able to raise more capital, but have built great product, have built whatever, right? Great distribution. Mm-hmm. We then take over those companies, let the founder transition to a new role somewhere else or internally within Pulse. But those companies, we kind of turn them around. We revive them. So it's technically our intensive care unit where we turn around.
Yeah. Wow. So, okay, give me examples. So obviously Go Rocky was the build model. Co-build is Life by Petto. What is the rebuild model? I haven't seen that around. Because again, there's still value there. And that's what people don't understand is that sometimes the startup ecosystem, it's so easy. And it sucks when you hear it from your peers when, oh, you get labeled to be a zombie startup, right?
No, it's not. I think, yeah.
Right? Like, especially if it comes from another founder. Dude, you have no idea how weird it is that you label other zombie startups. If you're also in the same shithole that everybody else is, right? So there's a lot of value and there's only so many things as a founder that you can do that's under your control.
Yeah.
Right? Because there's so many things that can go wrong, right? But there's always value created. And I love this model that you guys do because you see through that value and still give it a new lease of life. But what's that model like and who's a good example for this?
MedHive is a good example if you've heard of them in the past.
Those are Foxmont dudes.
That's true. So backed by Foxmont and Pegasus, right? So we love the team. They had an unfair advantage of knowing the space, the problem.
Yep.
They were building a tech-led solution. And obviously the funding winter kind of meant that they didn't have access to further capital. But we felt that they had built a great supplier base, great knowledge of procurement and a tech platform. What we did is we said, you know what? We have 30 plus companies in the portfolio. Everyone's procuring. Why do you have to do procurement for external customers? You be the center of excellence for our own companies in the portfolio. And we, last month, it's been a few months since we've taken them in the rebuild model. And last month, they did a GMV of over 3.2 million pesos.
Wow.
It's not bad to start with. Yeah.
Right. That's amazing. And again, that's exactly what it is. And sometimes you just really have to go through that desert experience in order to see that there is an oasis waiting for you where you can actually thrive again. Right. And that's what it is. Now, several things I really wanted to know. So, of course, you have, again, what's the number? You have 39 active portfolio companies. This might be wrong or this might be right. I'm not sure if this is still accurate. But walk me through the type of founders. Because at the end of the day, if you're playing this early, this is a founder bet. This is a team bet at the start. What are the type of founders you guys like to bet on or co-work with or co-build with or co-build with or rebuild with?
Yeah. So the number is correct. It's 39 at this point in time. We have different sets of founders, right? I think the Go Rocky founder is an example of how early we can get founders or we like to partner with, right? Okay. He came in as an intern from Germany to the Philippines. He had no clue of Philippines as a market. He didn't know whether he wanted to even start up. He did an internship with us for 3 months, validated the men's health problem with us. And we believe that he was a great talent who had the ability to understand and dissect problems and solve for it. And we kind of picked him up. And we're glad that he decided to do that with us as well. And then you pair that with another co-founder called
Waki.
Yeah. Ex-PayMongo. Great guy. And the fact is, I have spoken to him about 3 years back. We had interviewed him for Shipper in Indonesia.
I met him when he was still a student. He invited me in at the name. That's how old I am.
Awesome. That's crazy. Yeah. So, this is a talent that I like. At that point in time, I couldn't get him because PayMongo did something better.
Yeah.
If there was a possibility to get him on board this time, why not? Right. So we do work with founders who are in their early 20s, fresh off school or 2-3 years of experience, but have high IQ, high EQ, have the ability to hustle maybe 16 to 18 hours a day, 7 days a week for the next 7 years.
Yeah.
That's one kind of founder. The second kind of founder is people who have spent about 20 plus years in corporates, who have built great networks, who know to solve problems in a structured manner, who can take businesses to extreme large scale. And one example is Vladimir, if you've heard of him, who runs one of our... He of Telth, which is a multi-product SaaS venture. Right. And he spent about, so he's one of those who incubated Consulta MD when he was part of Globe. And then he was, he spent a lot of time at Globe and Vlad, PJ.
Yes, right. I remember. Yeah. I met him. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he's another founder, right? So we like the 20 plus year corporate folks who have done it, who really just want an idea that's validated. They know how to execute. They didn't want to pick the idea. They just wanted someone else to pick the idea, give them the baseline and the support.
Run with it.
So that's the second kind of founders. We also, obviously are trying to bring in a lot more talent from abroad because some of the markets like India and Europe don't have a lot of white spaces to build in now, right? Mm. You have to be so niche, you have to be so deep, and you have to have access to a significant amount of capital.
Right.
And for them building here, and the fact is when you bring them here, the local talent gets to learn on how things happen in other markets and they kind of evolve as well.
Correct.
So these are the broad type of founders, but super blessed for the kind of founder profiles that we have.
Mm-hmm. But how do you decide which type of, because again, you've said that you, on certain areas, you already have a thesis. And you just really need to find the right founders who can validate and run with it. Or even those ones who already have willing to co-build. But is the deal different on a startup to startup basis? Or obviously, again, the game is equity. No venture capital. I mean, there I've seen one. It's because it's in a telco, which is 917. You're technically building it for Globe, right? The trade-off is they're going to pay you a nice
exit salary.
Not only an exit, a nice salary.
Salary.
But you only get 10% of whatever it's still Globe's property. Here, what's the upside for them? Because if this is equity, then if it does well, similar to Kindred, similar to Go Rocky, similar to Mediclick and everything else, then there's opportunity for you to get follow-on funding and actually run it at your own startup.
That's true. So for all founders, so in the build and the co-build model, it's founders and employees who would have the majority equity. It's not us as well, 63. We would have significantly lower compared to what the founders and employees will have collectively, right? That's one. So the upside for them is that they own the company. And this is their show. And they get to figure out what strategy that they need over the years, right? We just help them in the first few years. And at that post, them kind of getting their follow-on rounds, they have their own lives and they get to decide what they want to do with their ventures.
Got it.
So the upside for them, I think, is one, the fact that we did have an idea that was validated in terms of everything, not just the market size, not just the potential, but also the demand generation, the unit economics, all of those sorted, dusted. You don't have to go back to it, right? A foolproof package on table delivered to you.
Got it.
The second is you also do get some amount of capital to run the show for the next few months, which also gives you the time to keep growing the business 10%, 5%, 15% month on month and go to the next set of investors and raise more capital for you.
Got it.
But it also gives you a safety net in terms of salary, right? So it's not like jumping into an unknown sort of pit, but you know that you will have some amount of salary that ensures that your basics are sorted, right? And then it's the ecosystem, right? I think the ecosystem is unimaginable. We kind of believe today, a lot of the customer transactions that happen with one portfolio company leads to revenue for five other companies at the same time, right? Because there's a knock-on effect, right? So anyone buying anything from one of our portfolio companies might in some way be resulting in revenue to MedHigh because they end up doing procurement, right? Mm. So that's the kind of ecosystem that you have access to. So,
Now, okay, in terms of strategy, what is the strategy that you run? Because it's never a one-size-fits-all. I mean, there's for sure similarities, right? With every startup's heavily nuanced because at the end of the day, there's nuances in terms of the problem, the product that you need, and also the strength of the team. What's the overarching strategy you like to implement? Because of course, again, there's some ones that you need a little bit more hand holding on, and there's ones that are like, all right, run with it, go do amazing stuff that you guys are already doing. What's the strategy like?
So we have a couple of things, right? So first, we have leadership. Depending on the approach. So the build has a separate leadership, the co-build has a separate leadership, and the rebuild team has a separate leadership. Mm-hmm. Now, within those, also you have different stages. So what happens is, for the build side, any idea that's been incubated all the way till internal investment committee, there's a team. Once that is internal IC approved, there's another team in the build, which takes it to 3 months of positive EBITDA or the first external $100,000 raise. Got and then it graduates to the next set of leaders. So you have approach-wise leadership, and within that, you have stage-wise leadership. So the skill set that you need from an idea to IC is different from the first 0 to 1, and then from 1 to 10 is different, right?
Correct.
And then we have kind of productized the whole thing. So, you know, today, if there's any request from any founder for anything, we would raise a ticket internally to ensure that our teams are delivering to our founders. We use technology to understand 15 to 20 metric at a company level on a monthly basis, including actual versus budgeted and stuff like that, right? So we've productized everything that we possibly can. So the game plan is, one, don't try to do too much customize and allow companies to do too many things.
Okay.
A company should have core focus and then build your capabilities at a structured level and build products that monitor any breaks in between, sort of.
Makes a lot of sense. All right, last few questions before I let you go. I want to understand in terms of like the healthcare sectors or categories that you guys invest in. Because again, healthcare, yes, it's a vertical, but it's a whole new labyrinth of verticals in there. There's so many things. And even in one problem, you can skin the cat many ways. What are the other verticals that you still want to tap into? Or what are the verticals that you're still tapping into that you see a lot more opportunities to attack on?
For us, healthcare is a bit broad, right? Mm. So we do have companies like We Eat Organic that do organic food and beverages as well. So it's a bit broad because it's wellness or fitness or wellness 2.0, whatever you call it, right?
Yep.
And within this, the way we look at it is the broad three categories or subcategories that we're focused on is healthcare access. It could be online, offline, or hybrid. And then you have healthcare infrastructure. These are the two broad themes that we're going behind, and anything that's functional, right? So any functional expertise that's common to these two pieces. So it could be procurement, it could be technology, whatever, right? So these are the three broad themes that we're going behind. However, what we kind of see is off late, there's extreme interest in healthcare access. Mm. And especially if you're an omni-channel play, right? With a large offline plan. So we're going aggressive with our offline strategy at this point in time because that's where, yeah, the market is headed at least.
That is amazing. All right. We have a few more questions, but I'll ask now the one question that I don't want to ask. And again, this is verbatim from Eileen Borromeo of Life by Pedo. So she asks, do you have a favorite Portco? LOL.
Yeah, I kind of knew this would come up at some point in time.
But I never asked these things. This is yeah, her, no, man. No, I never put my guess onto that
no,
stuff.
You don't. I mean, you don't have a favorite, right? Mm. Our logic is, so the VC game is always about 2 of 10 companies or 3 of 10 companies being outlier successes and you get the whole of fund returns, right?
Correct.
In our case, our belief is, there will be those outliers. There will be those 2 or 3 companies. But those companies became successful because those founders were at the right place and executed well. It was not because we did what we did.
Correct.
Our energy should go to the rest 6 and 7 of 8 companies, right? Because
pulling them up.
That's where our value is. So we don't have any favorites, but we obviously can name a few brands which are good at what they do. So Life by Pedo, we love their branding. They're one of the best in terms of branding, right? Mm-hmm. If you ask us who has one of the best HR strategies, we could name them. So, we know companies that are really good at one element, and we obviously kind of want others to learn from them as well.
Correct. And of course, you have also the big ones that are really are able to raise follow-on funding, like again, Koraki, like Kindred with just the mess of the limb again. So the proof is in the pudding, and that's good. But I want to understand. So you've been obviously a founder, you've been guy number 2, guy number 3, and now you're nurturing all these startups under your wing. So by helping them learn and guiding them through the process, you also learn new things in the process. What has that journey been like? What are these new learnings that you accrued by helping all these 39 startups under you?
I think for me, it's more importantly in how important it is to be transparent about problems, right? I think it's very difficult for a founder to kind of always talk about what's bothering them. They try to stay bold, right? They don't want the world to know what's going on, right? And if you really want to help a founder, and if you are an investor or if you're a mentor, you need to now have the skills to allow them to open up. Don't expect that they will come and knock your door and say, you know what, this is bothering me.
Correct.
Not everyone has the ability to do it. They're going to try to solve it as much as they can. But if there's a way that you can enable them to open up, and they don't even expect an answer from you. They just want to open up and they just want to feel lighter, right?
Correct.
I think that's what I've learned now. How do you kind of let the founder vent their frustration when they weren't prepared for it so that they can feel good after that conversation?
Right.
Yeah, that's one thing that I've learned. And I just think that's super important. How do you kind of let founders stay sane?
Yeah. And because again, there's so many few outlets that you can actually get that out in the rawest form possible, because you cannot put that in your employees. On certain levels, yes, you can do that in your co-founders. It depends on your relationship. But only people that have understood that exact same journey, that exact same predicament, can actually fully understand how to solve it. And sometimes all it takes, and you're completely right, is to just get it off your chest. Because in that process, you'll actually figure out, I actually know what to do. I don't need it. And you just need to get the 500-pound gorilla off your back, right? But I want to understand now, again, this is just the beginning of the journey. 39 startups, but the whole problem is the size of Asia, right? In terms of what that is. What's next? What should we anticipate more in Pulse 6.3, again, considering in the Filipino sphere of things? But a lot of the problems that you're also going to be solving can also, again, be replicated in other markets. What's up next for you guys?
So we're launching 6 other markets right now. Yep. So we're close to launching Pulse Bangladesh, which we think will be our launchpad for South Asia, excluding India. So we kind of consider Philippines as a launchpad for Southeast Asia. We build companies here and our companies will end up going to other markets in Southeast Asia.
Right.
So we're launching Bangladesh. We're launching South Africa for Southern Africa. We're launching Nigeria, Kenya, Egypt, and Chile for Latin America. So we want to play this game for all emerging markets,
right?
With one launch pad per emerging region.
That is amazing. Again, what is it going to be apples to apples similar to because I've obviously it's heavily nuanced, right? There's very, 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 very nuanced. Bangladesh is obviously a Muslim country as being East Pakistan before during the partition. But what do you see? There's a common denominator aside from it being an emerging market. Is it the GDP? Is it the population growth? Or what's the common denominator across all of these?
So a few things, right? So one is a lot of the macro factors are pretty similar, right? The kind of population size, the GDP the per capita income, the education levels, all of those. Right? So some of the macroeconomic factors are consistent across these markets, plus minus here and there.
Right.
On the other side, the startup maturity in these countries are also similar, right? Mm. You don't have a lot of startups that have raised more than $10 million. You don't have a lot of VCs, right? So we think we do well in emerging market with same macroeconomic conditions and where startup maturity is similar. So that's the kind of consistency in these.
That is amazing. Again, thanks so much, Abdul. That was such an amazing episode. I wish we had more time, but I know you also have to hustle forward. But before I let you go, please invite people over if they want to become a startup founder, if they want to work with the startups that they have, or they need their startup to be rebuilt. Where do they go and how do they work with you?
Reach out to us, Abdul, at pulse63.com or on our website. And we usually reply back in 24 hours.
He did reply within like 5 minutes when I picked it up. And that's rare, by the way. Most people don't reply. It's annoying, by the way. But again, this guy replies, that's amazing. And again, glad we are now able to immortalize the journey of Paul 63. I'm pretty sure I'm going to have you back on the show on Founders Only. But for now, this is it. But before I let you go, follow us on whatever podcast app you're listening to, whether it's Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if we did say some jargon, it's going to be the show notes on HustleChair.com. And if you want to also support HustleChair and doing content like this, please do subscribe at premium.hustleshare.com. Again, Abdul, thank you very much.
Thank you a ton for having me here.
All right, I had fun, and I'll see you guys in the next episode. Peace.